GradCast, the official radio show and podcast of the Society of Graduate Students at Western University. I am your host, Anthony Cruz.
And I'm your co-host, Carly Sharon.
And we are here with Rhea Sidhu. Thanks for being here, Rhea. Thanks for stepping up to the mic.
Thanks for having me.
Of course. Could you start by telling us a little bit about your program and what you're doing?
Yeah, so I'm a fourth year PhD student in psychology, specifically in the cognitive developmental and brain sciences stream of psych. And I'm also doing a music cognition specialization, which is an interdisciplinary specialization across the music faculty, some psych and neuroscience people, and I'm in Dr. Jessica Gron's lab.
Very exciting. And what type of stuff do you research here at Western?
So my lab's a music and neuroscience lab. I have strayed a little bit away from music, but some of my research still pertains to that. So a few of my first studies relate to groove, which is our desire to move along to music. It's like how you want to tap your foot along to the beat, or if you want to like get up and dance, and looking at that with individual differences. So a lot of studies have taken into account music training on people's groove experience, but they haven't actually considered things like dance training, which seems like a fairly obvious thing to look at because people who move a lot to music might experience that differently. And more interested, and more recently, I've gotten into the idea of empathy and that effect on groove, which seems like a big jump. But there's some studies that suggest that empathy is related to kind of your just responsivity to cues or your ability to predict other people's movements. So there's a lot of things on interpersonal synchronization and empathy, and this would just be synchronizing to other cues such as music and how empathy is involved. And then my other two studies are mildly related to this. I am kind of a little all over the place in what I study. I do also look at some gait research or walking research because my lab does a fair amount of that. We look at different walking patterns and cueing. So using what we refer to as rhythmic auditory stimulation, which is when you play a metronome or music and it kind of gives people a cue to walk on beat. So this is used for patients with Parkinson's disease. That's primarily what we look at in the lab, but we do a lot of studies on healthy controls to kind of do some basic science. I actually have switched away from music and I got really interested in this idea of, okay, well, what would a good visual cue be for this kind of synchronizing your steps to an external cue? And I landed on another human walking in front of you. So I actually use virtual reality in those studies to look at if people first off spontaneously synchronize to cues, so either this person walking in front of them or just the sound of footsteps, which is akin to a metronome. And then again, looking at things like music and dance training and empathy and how that might affect people's intentional as well as spontaneous synchronization. And then my last study.
So much going on.
Yeah, there's a, well, fourth year PhD, yes, I should have, yeah, true. More than one thing. And then my last study, I actually got to go and do set up at the University of Oslo through a MyTax Global Inc. Research Award. I got a little bit of funding to go there. And that study is, again, looking at synchrony, but this time it's looking at synchrony to humans versus objects. So we have videos of like a human swaying back and forth and a video of like a metronome. And we ask people to synchronize to that. And again, we're looking at empathy, music and dance training to see there's some theorizing that the reason why empathy is related to kind of these synchronization abilities is because if you're good at empathizing, that's like, oh, I'm good at putting myself in your shoes. I'm good at imagining what it is you're going through. And that ability to kind of perspective take actually makes you better at predicting what someone's going to do because you can like imagine being them kind of thing. And so if that's the case, we would expect empathy to be associated to our synchrony with other human things, but not to objects. So all of those are kind of up in the air at the moment. But yeah, generally just very like synchronizing to a lot of different cues and then looking at individual factors that might affect this.
Sounds like you don't have enough going on.
Yeah, I think you should take on like at least one more project.
I don't know. I feel like because there's like a lack of like a clear through line, it's like so all over the place and messy. So yeah, but I'm not going to lie, coming on this podcast, I feel like I got super worried about just like when Anthony was like, we just need a summary of your research. I was like, I don't know how to summarize my research.
You did a great job.
Yeah, I thought it was good.
Yeah, but like being like, when people have like one sentence, they're like, I study this. It's like, I don't have that.
Yeah. Well, maybe we can start. I'm most interested in the one where you're looking at the groove. How do you measure groove?
So it's really simple. So you just look at ratings of, so groove is kind of has these two components. So it's your desire to move, and it's also this aspect of pleasure. So you like I think there are some examples, like maybe the YMCA or the chicken dance, where you have this desire to move and it's not necessarily pleasurable, but that's a pretty rare groove experience. But so we literally just will put, ask people, how much does, like, listen to this music clip on a scale of 0 to 100, how much does it make you want to move? And actually for my specific studies, I'm trying to look at the difference, because a wide range of questions are used. Some are just like, how much did you want to tap your foot along? How much did you want to move some part of your body? Or how much did you want to dance? And all of these have kind of been treated as the same thing. But like, I just remember having an experience listening to a song, and I was like, a song that makes me want to bob my head along is very different to me than a song that makes me want to dance. So those things feel kind of separate to me, because I think tapping and bobbing are kind of this beat tracking, simple movement. Like, I feel like rock, you're gonna like more likely to kind of like bob your head along, but you don't necessarily want to like start dancing full out. Whereas if you're listening to something more like R&B, hip-hop, funk, where the, maybe you want to move a little bit more to that. But yeah, it's really simple, just like ratings of perceived groove. Some studies some research looks at elicited groove, so that would actually be like putting people in motion capture and looking at how much they move along to music.
And so you have them listen to a music clip. Is it the same clip for everyone, or do you switch it up?
So I've done quite a few groove studies. For the majority of them, we use 40 music clips. I kind of took them from Spotify. A big kind of predictor of groove is familiarity. Mm-hmm. So the more familiar you are with a song, the more it's probably going to make you want to move, which makes sense because you're also going to like it more and then maybe listen to it. So I tried to pick unfamiliar songs to people. So I think I used like under 1 million streams on Spotify is kind of like a benchmark for that. So I think in the I've done 4 or 5 just online groove studies. They're fairly easy to do. I've used usually 2 sets of playlists and people get randomly assigned. But I have also done some studies. Look, a really fun one was, I got really interested in this idea of nostalgia and groove, because there's this weird thing where, like, I see it at weddings or on a night out, like the songs that like people run to the dance floor for are like the throwbacks. I was joking with Anthony the other day of like Sean Paul is like kind of like one that like
temperature starts playing and everyone goes crazy.
Like, gets me out on the dance floor. And it's like something about that nostalgic aspect of it, of whether or not it was playing at my like junior high dance or whatever. And we actually did find that specifically nostalgic songs made us want to dance, but not necessarily affected our move and tap ratings. So there was something really like interesting and unique there. So we can use a wide range of songs. I primarily stick with using like, I don't know what the right word is, but like naturalistic songs. So like songs you'd find on Spotify. A lot of groove studies can just use like drum beats or really simple things to, if you're interested in manipulating really precise like music qualities, like syncopation is one, or like beat salience. But I kind of like the idea of, I feel like you're going to get the strongest results when you are using things that people actually listen to, even if it's unfamiliar, but it's still like a full song.
Oh, it's really cool.
Yeah, this is super cool. I already knew that Stella got her groove back, and now I know what groove is. Thanks so much for that. I think I would love to participate in one of your studies. It sounds like a lot of fun. You're just listening to music. How does that make me feel? That sounds so fun.
Yeah, in my master's, I did more specific timing research, and it was literally like people looking at a screen and hitting the space bar when they see a circle flash. And like, as a researcher, you often have to go through your study a few times, like make sure everything's in order. And it was awful to do. And I just remember thinking like, I don't want to make boring studies for people to participate in. Cause also I feel like a huge thing is like, thinking about the participant experience, because if a participant's super bored during your study, doesn't understand what's going on, it's easy for their mind to wander or do other things. You're not getting good data. Mm-hmm. And, like, I think it's not talked about enough. Like, when it's like, oh, they sat through 322 trials of this. It's like, well, of course, like, your data's messy because there's no way the person was properly attending and doing your tasks the whole time. Mm-hmm. So I think, like, planning engaging studies and ones that are actually kind of interesting to people mm-hmm. actually makes a huge difference, and it helps me like trust my data a little bit more too.
Mm-hmm. No, that totally makes sense. Mm-hmm. And especially when you're pulling from that pool of like those psych 1000 kids, yeah. if you can have a study that's actually engaging for yeah. them, that'll definitely make a difference.
No,
sure.
It's so funny. I just have one thing at the end that's like, oh, anything you'd like to tell the researchers. And sometimes it's like, oh, this was really fun to do, because I've also put studies up on like Prolific, which is a more general like research tool to get recruitment. And some people are like, oh, this was great. And then sometimes I get people who are like, you had a great selection of music. And some people are like, you didn't have a good enough selection of music. Why didn't you have this genre or this genre? And it's like, I tried my best.
Well, I was actually going to ask about that, because I was wondering, like, everyone has different music tastes. So something that I might want to dance to could be very different from something Jordan wants to dance to. So, like, how do you kind of try to account for that?
Yeah, so I think we straight up have a question in one of our, in our studies that is like, what are genres you typically move along to? To be honest, I don't think we've done anything with that data yet. We haven't looked to see if it's affecting it, because with the main studies I've been doing and the one that will be included in my thesis, it's such a wide array that we tried to get, because our main thing, again, I'm not necessarily interested in, okay, what in a song is going to make people want to groove, is it's like, are there differences between these movement types and what are the individual differences that affect it? So some studies have like really intensely looked at genre. I'm not doing that as much, but it's definitely a thing to take into account with like anything in psychology. Just individual differences mm-hmm. is a huge thing to consider.
You're touching on this idea of individual differences. Can you like elaborate on that a little bit?
Yeah, so individual differences is when we talk about studies, we'll be like, there's a main effect of this, or like X increased Y. And those are the general average findings of across the whole sample. We took the mean or the average and kind of saw that it was bigger in this group than this group. But individual differences really touches on the idea that every single person has like a wealth of different experiences and things that are maybe going to affect their results. So individual differences can be something from like age. So how old you are might affect what you, for my studies, potentially like with gait, we see walking patterns change as people get older. So then if you're studying a wide range of ages, you want to take into that age as an individual difference that is going to affect the results. Or for some studies, you can still use things like gender. But also for mine, if you can imagine, less so with groove, but my lab also does a lot of like beat perception and beat production ability. So musicianship, or how long you've done music training, is probably going to affect that. So looking at things that are going to vary across your population, and then actually taking that into account and either throwing it in as like a correlation, or actually defining groups of these were our dancers, these were non-dancers, are we seeing differences across those?
So you said at the start that you're looking at how people's music training and dance training affects their groove. What have you found so far with that?
Yes. So when we have our desire to generally move ratings, our desire to tap ratings, and our desire to dance ratings, and what we've found, so I have three studies, this replicated in two and one it did not, but musicians, or desire to tap ratings were influenced by whether or not people had music training. So people with, I think, more music training, it's just, it had more of an, like using a linear regression, which is essentially checking for variance. Music training accounted for a decent amount of the variance for desire to tap ratings, but not for these desire to move and dance ratings. But for dance training, we saw that it affected the desire to move and dance ratings, but not the desire to tap. Mm-hmm. So there's something specifically in the way that we're asking the question of, okay, well, if we're looking at groove, if we do it the way that we've always been doing it with move, we would think, oh, dance is affecting this, but music isn't. But tapping along is still a form of groove. So then you're seeing this, oh, well, music is affecting this, but dance isn't. And then again with dance, the opposite, mm-hmm. where music isn't affecting it, but dance is. So there is something to say of just like, yeah, people who do music training, you, if you go to any like band concert and stuff, you'll see everyone kind of tapping their foot along. Mm-hmm. Maybe there is that more ability to just like track the beat more than kind of the average population, so they're doing that. Whereas dance is a really interesting thing because a lot of people are really uncomfortable with dance. A lot of people find dancing really anxious. As soon as you change the word from move to dance, ratings just lower. Because people are like, I don't dance, like kind of thing, which is so interesting to me because I came into the lab really interested in just dance as a whole, because dance is like ultimately this really joyful thing. Like if you think of when you dance at like weddings or like football celebrations, or like it's always moments of like intense joy. So it's, or not even intense joy, but just like having a good time. But then people are so like self-conscious about dancing and anxious like when it comes to dancing, and they'll be like, I can't dance till I have a couple drinks or whatever.
That's me.
But it's meant to just be this like fun, free, like self kind of expression thing, and yet people are so like guarded with it. So it's really interesting to me.
Well, it's funny that you say that because my sister has done dance for like 10 plus years, and we were at a wedding this summer and she would not go out on the dance floor. She did not want anything to do with going on the dance floor. Like she had to have a couple drinks before we could go out and dance. So
you see that a lot with like really like trained dancers, is they're like, well, yes, I can do like a pas de bourrée or whatever, but they're like, but I can't, I don't know how to dance on dance floor. So one thing we look at is the scale we use. We get a measure of dance training as well as like social dancing, because those are very different things. And the idea of some people are comfortable with dancing and some people aren't. So that's also, we see generally our lowest ratings with desire to dance, kind of unsurprisingly, just because it is something where people are like, oh, I don't do that. But then our description for moving along to music isn't that different. But there is just something as soon as you throw that word, like, are you dancing versus are you moving to music, that people are like, oh, no, I'm not dancing.
Yeah, they don't want the spotlight on them. Yeah. Not good enough for that.
Yeah, there's more attention with dancing.
Yeah.
I'm curious about these walking studies that you mentioned now as well. You said you're doing some stuff in VR that you set up in Oslo?
No, so sorry. The Oslo project is the human versus objects. The VR project is here at Western.
Can you talk a little bit more about the VR project?
Yes. So, like I said, our lab does a lot of gait studies in general. So we look at the effect of cues on walking. So as I said, our most common example is, people with Parkinson's disease, what happens is they have kind of a slower, more shuffling gait. They're also more likely to kind of freeze when they're walking. And if you use these kind of cues, such as a metronome or music, there is some evidence that it can kind of stop or reduce the freezing or kind of extend their gait. So this idea of, okay, providing this external cue is actually giving them kind of this framework of like, okay, I'm gonna walk on each beat and improve it. So this is a really interesting idea of, oh, this external cue in the environment is affecting or helping people synchronize their walk to something. So some people in our lab focus on that. And then if you kind of boil it down to like the basic science of it, a lot of research has shown that like these auditory cues are really effective, but visual cues typically aren't. But it's because a lot of studies have used visual cues like a flashing light, and it's like walk in time to this flashing light, or things like that, that are just like, when have you ever tried to do that in your life? And they're very simple visual cues, because in essence, a light appearing and disappearing is the same as like a tone appearing and disappearing. But this whole idea is that the auditory kind of processing is more kind of tuned for temporal or timing information, whereas our visual system is better for spatial information. So some studies that have had some effect with using visual cues utilize spatial information. So there's like a series of studies on like just getting people to tap along to something, and they show that like a bouncing ball where you hit when it hits the ground, you're a lot better at that than like a flashing light. So just adding movement really increases like your kind of temporal precision with doing these things. So then I was kind of stuck on, okay, what would be a good visual cue that's a little bit more complex? And then kind of just actually a study I came across kind of led me into this like human direction, which was they found that videos of like, they're referred to as point light displays, and it's essentially this like motion capture where you have lights on each of the joints and it's connected with lines, so kind of this like skeleton thing, and they had people judge the tempo or the speed at which these like things were moving at, but the auditory and visual information was like slightly mismatched. So sometimes the track that was playing over it was like sped up or slowed down, or sometimes the actual movement itself was sped up or slowed down. And they found that the tempo judgments were more affected by the body movement than the actual auditory, which was surprising because of the whole like auditory is for temporal information. So it was this idea that, oh, biological motion seems to be unique at affecting our like it portraying temporal information. So I was like, oh, biological motion or human motion, like that's something kind of thing. And then you think about, okay, well, how am I going to get a person to walk in front of this person who's doing the study? And you're like, well, I guess I could walk in front of them, but then that's really hard to control. So then this idea of virtual reality came in of, okay, we can put people in a headset and have this avatar walk in front of them. And then see if they can follow it. And then, yeah, use the sound of footsteps. So that one came about in a very interesting way of just, like, kind of taking a paper at a time and going, oh, well, what about this? And then it kind of ended up working out and using, again, like, music and dance experience because dancers have a lot of experience, like, following another form. They're like, I say, you're never going to enter a dance studio without at least one full wall of mirrors. Like, it's all about watching yourself and watching others, and there's a lot of like emphasis on the visual domain in dance, whereas music, there's a lot of emphasis on the auditory domain. So interested in seeing if like dancers will be more affected by the person walking in front of them than musicians who are hearing something and using that information.
That's so interesting. And I think we've all been in like that situation where you kind of find yourself walking in the exact same rhythm as the person next to you.
Not me. I'm always passing them.
I'm a fast walker.
Yeah, walking, like, yeah, that's a really common thing of like you kind of like step in stride with others. There's also really interesting work that looks at like your relationship with someone else and how that affects it. So I think this study found that like if it's a guy and a girl and they're just friends, the guy will slow down a little bit and the girl will speed up a little bit. But if they're in a relationship, the guy slows down all the way to the girl's speed or something like that. So it's like who you're walking with matters and your relationship to this person matters. And it was like talked about like also like male and male friends and female friends and like how you walk differently depending on who you're with. And it's just all very interesting.
Yeah, wow. So I was curious, like you, again, you're looking at music training and dance training. I'm assuming the dancers probably responded better to the VR than the musically trained people?
So we ran this study once. We actually have to rerun it because there was an issue with it. So I can't speak too much about the results of that one. But when we were looking at it, we did find overall people were influenced pretty similarly across both the auditory and visual cues, which was interesting because everyone's like, oh, like auditory information like should be much better. But you also have this a bit of this confound of when you actually have this like human being in front of you, like sometimes people wouldn't want to pass it, right? And then sometimes people were keeping a certain distance from it, and there was a lot of interesting social stuff going on, which then came into this idea of like, oh, maybe like is empathy affecting this as well? And we're also in this new iteration of it. We're looking at like affiliation with the thing because I remember someone once commented they were like on a trial that didn't have the person, they were like, oh, I miss like them, like where'd they go? And so it's just kind of like interesting. But we had this horrible problem at the beginning of this where it seems like such a simple thing, but people go in this kind of racetrack like oval form, and one thing that's unique, well, not unique to human walking, but we slow down on turns. Just when we're turning, we typically slow our pace. Our avatar does not. So what would happen with her was our avatar would essentially just gain on the participant to the point where it would kind of lap them. But when it lapped them, you can imagine when you're looking through this VR, it has this appearance of it like going through you.
Oh.
And so like, I think one person screamed, like it was so bad. And like people would stop in their tracks, which is not what we wanted. We found a way around this. We just like shortened it so the avatar didn't have enough time to like lap this person. But it's one of those things where you're like, I'm just going to use VR for one of my studies and it'll be fun and fine. And then you're like, oh, why are these people terrified?
New research question. How does terror impact your
And like we tried to make our avatar like this, like we went super gender neutral. So like on all like the things, there's a bit of a scale. It kind of ended up looking like Ellen DeGeneres. So people were just like, why is Ellen DeGeneres like stalking me?
Yeah.
That's the real jump scare.
Yeah. Now that her show's done, she's had to find other avenues of income.
You heard it here first. Ellen DeGeneres is haunting the Werb.
I just can't even imagine, like, you sitting there and people just scream in terror. Well,
yeah, because
I... With his headset on, oh my gosh.
No, because I can see what they see. So, like, I can kind of tell, I'm like, oh, it's getting close. It's getting close. It's like, is it gonna lop them? And originally I didn't realize this would be a problem because we do set our cues, like, a little bit faster, a little bit slower. So on the faster ones, this was obviously more likely to occur. And yeah, it would just, like, start happening and we were like... Okay, and then I'd try to warn people, but they'd still kind of be like, what is happening?
The avatar's gonna enter you in 3, 2, 1. Yeah.
I again say, I would love to participate in your research.
Oh, you can for sure be a pilot once it's up and running again.
Oh, that's too funny. Well, we're almost near the end, but I'd like to hear about your experience in Oslo. Like, you actually got to go there and do your work there?
Yeah, so I was there for 3 months. Oh, wow. I was at the University of Oslo. There's a specific research center called RITMO, which studies, like, rhythm in time and motion. So I'd heard about that through just, like, from conferences, like, being in kind of the music psychology field. And they have a really cool motion capture setup. So they have, like, this really fancy 4Ms lab that they have, and I wanted to be able to do some motion capture work, and that seemed like a good place to do it. And I also was like, if I can get funding to go to another country for a couple months, like, why wouldn't I? And my supervisor was super supportive of it. So found someone who had similar research interests, Jana Vuoskowski, who, she does a lot of empathy research and empathy in music. So I kind of told her about this empathy and synchronization thing. We came up with a project, and then I got there, and it was like that idea of, oh, I'm gonna, like, collect data for the study. But in the 3 months, I basically just got the study up and running, and now someone's collecting data for me. But it was a lot of, like, learning new technologies. Also at a new university, like, the amount of admin tasks, like, had to go to the IT desk because my login wasn't working and they need to see my passport for some reason. So 3 months flew by.
Yeah.
But it was a really fun experience, and I really enjoyed Norway. It was like a perfect mix of, like, Europe and Canada.
Oh, nice.
So it was very nice.
Awesome.
Do you have any words of advice for someone else who might be interested in my techs?
Honestly, just go for it, because the application isn't too intense, and, like, it's like, it seems maybe a little more daunting than it is to go somewhere for a short term. But, like, the experience of it, and just, it really pushes you in a lot of ways, I think, being in another country at all. It's also so valuable if you're thinking of staying in academia, of just seeing how other labs and how other research sites work and getting an experience of that, especially if you've done your, like, master's and PhD at the same place. I think just getting more experience in research in different settings is really interesting. And every prof has, like, kind of different ways of doing things, so it's also nice to work with someone else and get other layers of expertise from someone. So definitely worthwhile. It does take quite a, like, the timing of it is usually the trickiest thing, because I originally was like, oh, I'll go in summer, and then when I was talking to the director of the center, he was like, no one is here in July, like, you are not going to interact with another person. And I was like, okay, then, like, I guess I'll go during the school year, but then, like, so, like, we have a mandatory course we're supposed to have, so making sure that it was okay that I was missing that. So there is quite a bit of, like, admin and that kind of stuff that can seem daunting with it, but overall, like, it's 100% worth it. And, like, even if it ends up being, like, bad, like, you got to live in another country for 3 months, that's pretty great.
Yeah, nice. Yeah.
Well, we are about to have to cut you footloose, Rhea, but thank you so much for this interview. This has been GradCast, the official radio show and podcast of the Society of Graduate Students at Western University. I've been your host, Anthony Cruz. My co-host was Carly Sharon, and we've been speaking with Rhea Sidhu. And this episode was produced by Jordan Vanderbert. If you would like to be involved with the show or get in contact with us, email us at gradcast@sogs.ca. You can follow us on Instagram, Facebook, or Twitter at GradCast Radio. To listen to us, we are on Radio Western 94.9 FM. You can find all of our episodes wherever you find your podcasts. Thank you for listening, and enjoy the rest of your day.